Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparita de sangamatasa tavara ye sodavanta bhavunjantu satang. So this afternoon is an opportunity to reflect on Dhamma. And it's a time where, this is my opinion, my feeling, where there's great freedom to examine life itself. We're not to be able to investigate experience. It's not just a few mystics or specially endowed people, but there's so much information available now on Dhamma, on ultimate reality. And of course, religions are about relating to ultimate reality. But what is that? What do we mean by that? Those are fine English words, but in Pali language we call it Dhamma, ultimate reality. And yet in the world we live in, it's all about good and bad, right and wrong, true and false. And so we live in this very dualistic existence by identifying with the forms that manifest and change and begin and die, get born and die. So ultimate reality is, in terms of definition, they call it the deathless. And so when we try to create an image of deathlessness, we think of me or you living eternally in a state of bliss as individual souls or separate forms, or we attain a state of bliss or union with ultimate reality or with God, and then for eternity we're blissful. But do you really not understand what bliss is? The idea is inspiring. Eternal bliss is a ideal that we all would like to have, be permanently happy, permanently blissful. And yet the English word bliss is oftentimes used with like drug taking, blissed out on drugs and things like that. So it's a kind of high state that's very temporary. But bliss is really our true nature. And bliss is here and now. And it's not created. But human beings don't really know that. They don't understand that because they're so conditioned to see themselves within the limitation of their form. So they're bound to the form that we identify with and the human body and its whether it's male or female, or monk or nun, or lay person, black or white, whatever, the identity is always toward identifying with form. And forms are all impermanent. They're not, you can't, if you expect to find eternal bliss in a form, you'll be sadly disappointed, disillusioned. So then when we try to conceive of eternal bliss, you know, it sounds, the words are very attractive. Most people would long for that, to be blissful for eternity. But how can you ever expect anything to be blissful for anything for very long as you identify with the limitations of form? So the world that we identify with is the play of five elements: earth, fire, water, air, and space. And they're all conditions that arise and cease. So we begin to see the ignorance that the Buddha pointed at. Avijja, bhajya sankhara, this ignorance informs consciousness. And so the consciousness then divides into nama rupa and the six senses, salayatana, and onward. So that we live in a world of division, of ignorance. And so the world that we identify with is basically unsatisfactory, is suffering. And that's what the Buddha pointed to in his first sermon. There is suffering. Then the third noble truth is about eternal bliss, Nirodha. When you see suffering, when you realize suffering, not to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, or thinking. When you go inward, look inward at yourself, you see, you begin to notice the temporariness of thought. Emotions arise and cease, views come and go. The senses themselves can weaken, and their power to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think can erode and disappear. The senses, what in Pali, in the Paticca Samuppada Salayatana, they arise out of ignorance. Nama Rupa Salayatana. And so this world that we would like to make perfect, we can't do it. Because we're operating from avijja, or ignorance of eternal bliss, or absolute reality, or the Dhamma. So the forms are manifestations. You know, we're born and we die. These forms are all about birth and death and change, old age, sickness, death. And these are not inspiring subjects to contemplate. We'd like to talk about eternal love or eternal bliss or happiness or complete freedom. We can think of, with our language, the ultimate words for the best we can possibly create with language. But the world is like this. You know, it's imperfect. His very nature is imperfect, unsatisfactory. And when we cling to the world, then we suffer from it, because how could it be otherwise? How could we not suffer if we identify, our soul identity is with the body, with our feelings, with our conditioning. So this is a reflection. It's not like I'm trying to teach you anything, but it's like for you to consider, investigate this. Are you really the body that you identify with? Is this what you ultimately are? These are important questions to ask yourself. Are you really a man or really a woman? Is this your ultimate nature? Are you really a Buddhist or a Christian? You know, so then these questions don't need answers, but they're ways of investigating. So in my life as a Buddhist monk in meditation, I question, is this body really what I am? And by asking that question, I began to observe the body changes according to conditions. You know, and so it gets sick, it gets old, it will die, this body's going to die soon. And that's the nature of the body. So when I look at the body, I think of, you know, of the functions of it, eating food every day, swallowing the food, excreting the food, the waste food, and on like that. That happens through a lifetime of a human body. Then the eyes are, you know, weaken, or one can go blind, and the senses are undependable. We can create images, we have imagination. When we were flying back from Portugal a few days ago, Ajahn Asoka asked me about that Madonna. There's a very famous where two farm children saw the Virgin Mary in a field, and I'd been to that. When I visited Portugal before, I'd been to that place. It's a huge area where pilgrims come to worship the Madonna. And did these children make it up when the Virgin Mary came and spoke to them? And was it just childish imagination, or why did she really appear? We can doubt that or believe it. You know, if we're Christian or Catholics or Portuguese, we can actually believe that that's what actually happened. Or if you're a doubter or an atheist or not a Catholic, then you can say it's just somebody's imagination. But Virgin Mary's appeared to Christians, people who identify with Christian. Their conditioning is Christian. So they don't see Krishna or Vishnu or Allah or Sufi saints. They see Jesus or Virgin Mary. So this is what the imagination can create. If we have faith, we have blind faith in an illusion, we tend to, the mind can create the illusions. So the more we are ignorant and trust in our beliefs, our images, our conditioning, then we tend to interpret experience always through that limitation. So this is what the formed world, like Virgin Mary, is a form that came and appeared and disappeared. In India, they see Lord Krishna or Ganesha or the Hindu deities. The Tibetans can see the various forms of Buddhas through their forms of meditation. When the meditation is always based on form, through that kind of belief and utter commitment to a form, we tend to interpret experience and have unusual experiences that are not the ordinary mundane experience of ordinary people. But whether you're ordinary or extraordinary, the body, the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the nose, the brain, the orifices of the body are illusory. They're changing, they change according to conditions. Conditions are endlessly changing in this play of samsara, this illusory world that we hope and dread or deny. So what is ultimate reality? What is eternal bliss? And so when you try to imagine it, you can't. Your thinking mind just can't imagine eternal bliss without a form. So you think of eternal bliss as I can create an idea that I have a separate soul from you. My soul is personal and yours is personal for you, but not for me. I can believe in things like that. They can be quite rationally agreeable to believe in, that we each have our separate eternal souls. And they're the ones that spend, if we lived right, keep the precepts, and are kind and generous and so forth, then we will attain eternal bliss as a separate soul. But can you actually find your separate soul? You know, is it something you can imagine it? I can easily imagine myself having a separate soul. But through investigation, am I really what I imagine? And through my insight, I realize I'm not a separate soul. There is no separate soul. That the form that I've been told is what I am. I have a passport, birth certificate, proof that I am Robert Jackman. That was the name given to me by my parents. That I am Sumita Bhikkhu, that's the name given to me by my Upachaya. I've got certificates and forms that I can verify to according to the worldly values. But they're impermanent too. So birth certificates can disappear, passports can be burned and on like that. So you need proof that you exist? You need to prove that you are somebody who will live forever with eternal bliss? Or is it your true nature already? It's like trying to find yourself. One time I remember feeling I'm looking for my glasses, my spectacles, and I looked all over my kuti and I couldn't find them. I realized I was wearing them. So that's what it's like, trying to find yourself as some kind of object or as some kind of name or entity. You can't, you know, you can imagine, create images or beliefs is the best we can do as an ignorant person. But enlightenment is actually realizing your true nature. It's perfect already. It's never been blemished, no matter how many sins you've committed or not committed. The Dhamma is perfect. It's blissful here and now. It's not born or created. And this is what the Buddha pointed to in his Four Noble Truths teaching. Nirodha, the third noble truth, according to the conventional form, is consciousness knowing itself. Like you suddenly realize this reality of here and now, where I can actually witness the forms. And then I'd ask myself, can one form witness another form? You know, so is that, you know, I can look at you, I can see you, but I can't see my own eyes. But seeing is the point. Seeing is the Dhamma doesn't have eyes. The Dhamma doesn't have senses. The Dhamma is formless, perfect, stainless, blissful, here and now, timeless. So it's not something you lack or you've got to get as a person. It's through the actual seeing the suffering involved in life as you try to find happiness in a form, in a relationship, in wealth, in power, in any way that we might try as an individual person. So what happens to right and wrong, good and bad, virtue and vice? Because the world that we believe and identify with is all about right and wrong, true and false, heaven and hell, virtue and vice. So then when we're caught in this dualistic way of experiencing life, it's all about right and wrong, what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's bad. And it varies according to individuals. Like a man having two wives, is that wrong? You know, in some societies that's right. Who decides what's right and wrong? You know, in modern society, you legally can't have two wives at the same time. It's wrong. It's a crime. These are labels we give to life and experience through the senses. It's all about right and wrong, good and bad, day and night. So life in this realm that we cling to, bind ourselves to, is the very source of suffering. It's not going to, you know, the predictions about climate change or artificial intelligence. You know, you listen to some of these YouTube videos and the predictions is robots are going to take over and destroy humanity, and artificial intelligence is dangerous, and because we see intelligence not through wisdom, but through definition, through what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. It's always going outward. So in artificial intelligence, you know, going into atoms, nuclear conditions and so forth, DNA, and all these new terms that have arisen in modern life about the minutiae, the smallness that conditioned forms can have, atoms. Because it's still going outward toward what we see or can prove through looking through binoculars or microscopes. So we're using high tech to keep our attention gazing out in outer space or in laboratories with a microscope investigating germs, viruses, on and on like that, getting smaller and smaller or more difficult to see. But the Buddha pointed the way to realize Dhamma is Opanayaka Dhamma, or going inward. So you're observing inward. You point to your heart usually, not to your brain. Your brain is like a computer. Brains don't feel anything. They don't feel emotions. But when we talk about emotions, we point to our heart. Why do we do that? Why do we see the emotion? Because we feel in this part of our body the love and hate and fear and jealousy here. The brain can be critical of it. You know, your brain can be doesn't fear, but ideally, you know, like, be fearless, be a man, grow up, don't be a coward. It's kind of advice given to men, generally speaking. There's nothing to fear. And there actually isn't anything to fear, because ultimate reality is here and now. It's not something that is frightening, but it's blissful. But it's ignored, not realized, when we're always going outward to objects, distracting ourselves. What we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, eat. How many people have problems with diets and food because eating is one of the sensual pleasures? When you're lonely and don't know what to do, you want to eat something. Smoke a cigarette. On and on like that. It's going, looking at the television or the iPhone, iPad. Because this is what we're conditioned to do. This is what human beings of the present age are conditioned to seek distractions through high tech. Where Dhamma is not about high tech. It's not high tech. It was pointed to very directly by the Buddha 2,565 years ago. So it's not like New Age philosophy or modern psychology. So it's what we inherit, one of the brilliant teachings that manifested through wisdom through the ascetic Gotama by realizing Dhamma for himself, as registered in the Pali Canon. So it's not New Age psychology or feel-good kind of teaching, trying to point to your ultimate character is already perfect. Take that stand in your true nature. Don't be petty and small-minded and identify with all your weaknesses or fears or thoughts or desires. So the teaching of the second noble truth is letting go of desire. Letting go. How do you let go of desire? You have to understand desire. The desire is a sankhara, it's not permanent. Desire arises and ceases according to conditions. So when we attach to desire, then we get depressed. Because we can say let go, and how do you let go? Tell me how to let go. And I've been asked this question many times. Ajahn Smita, how do you let go? And it's just letting go of everything. Can I describe it beyond saying it's just here and now, let go? And when you try to stop, when you stop figuring out how you should let go or how to let go, because that's thought, that's personal thought. I don't know how to let go. Ajahn Sumedho will tell me how to do it. I can't tell you how to do it. It's just something instinctive, natural, letting go. So the third kind of desire, vipavadana, is always trying to let go. The advice is good, you should let go, and then how do you let go? And then I can't let go, I still have these bad thoughts, these memories, and emotional problems, and I'm a depressive, I'm a bipolar, I'm sick schizophrenic, or I'm OCD, or PTSD, or there's all kinds of names now given to various kinds of emotional problems. Not that they're wrong, but when you identify with them, I am suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, then I tend to operate from that kind of identity. Fortunately, I've never identified with post-traumatic stress disorder. Sometimes I see a bit of OCD in myself, especially as you get old. You're prone to OCD because you become more helpless, and you want the monks that take care of you to do things in a certain way. And I can relate to that as part of just the aging process, not taking it personally, but I'm aware of it. I don't follow it. Sometimes I do, but other times I don't. I'm determined not to become a pain in the neck for the carers. And then last month I had this fantastic birthday celebration, which many of you remember, no doubt, and celebrating my 90th year. And but in my awareness, there's no age. Consciousness is ageless. It's not 90 years old. So then the body is 90 years old, and but that's an object now. It's not my identity. It's really the developing the path through right understanding of letting go of identities. So then people ask, all these years as a Buddhist monk, and what have you realized? I've realized I'm nobody. They say, have you reached stream entry? Are you an arahant? And that's a pretty aggressive question. Because those are forms. Those four stages are words, forms created by human beings. And can my personal habits, my personality, can it become an arahant? You know, so you become aware of your personality is very conditioned at an early age when you're an innocent child. And that can't become an arahant or a stream entry. To realize stream entry, sotapanna, is to realize emptiness, realize the end of suffering here and now. That's the path, consciousness, awareness of itself here and now, through non-attachment to forms, seeing the danger of attachment to desires and forms, no matter how wonderful or horrible they might be. So this is, you know, when you read the history of Gautama the Buddha, the stories are quite important, actually, because the temptations of Mara, when they have in Thai temples beautiful murals with the ascetic Gautama sitting under a tree and all the forces, pleasurable, horrifying, frightening forces come to tempt him. And the ascetic Gautama says, I know you, Mara. So Mara is the form world. And we know it, you know, because just by the ability to observe my right hand at this moment, through my vision, what is it? You know, without consciousness, my eyes wouldn't function. If my eyes go, if I go blind, then my hand's still here, but I can feel it. What is it that has manifested the six ayatanas, the eyes, nose, ears, tongue, body, the mind, the brain? How does that manifest and disappear? Can a sankhara create another sankhara? Or can it know another sankhara as a sankhara? Can it see the limitation of sankhara? Can it see the arising of a thought and the ending of a thought? Can it know the rising of an emotion and the ceasing of emotions? So letting go is actually witnessing the cessation of conditioned phenomena. And that's why this technique I like to encourage about noticing the words you use, like just the simple statement, I am, announcing the existence of being. You're not saying who you are yet. Just say, I am is a fair enough pronouncement of presence, of being. But I, the English personal pronoun, is only one letter. And so when we observe that, just intentionally witnessing, deliberately thinking, I, then there's nothing after it. And then we've been trained, conditioned to say am after I am. But the spaces in between the words are empty. And when we're caught in doubt, doubting is the attachment to thoughts. The more you think, the more you doubt. Once I asked Ajahn Chah about what the Thai word for crazy person is, and he said, one who thinks too much. I'd never thought of that before. I thought, I'm kind of crazy, actually. I think all the time. And I like thinking. I'm very attached, you know, I was very attached to thinking. Trying to gather all the information about Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism and then the different Zen Buddhists and Tibetan Buddhists and Mahayana Buddhists. And then I became interested in religion and in other religions and learned more about Zoroastrianism. Who knows anything about Zoroastrianism or some ancient Egyptian religion? One can find it interesting through the forms. But the space between the thoughts, between the words, is a major interest. I made that what I'm really dwelling on, the space between the words. Before I think I, there's a silence. And after I intentionally think I, there's silence. That silence is apparent here and now. It's the ground of being. It's consciousness. It's empty. And it's where the forms can manifest. Like the I am cannot manifest without space, without silence. When you try to run words together, you can't understand anything. It's total madness. So this is a very patient practice. And Lumpa Cha's first advice to me when I met him said, Sumedho, you have to learn to be patient. That was a basic teaching I got when I met Lumpa Cha in Ubon in 1967. And, you know, I recognize impatience, but I'm really, you know, I didn't know to what extent. I thought I'm a fairly patient person. My self-image was, I try to be patient. I like patient people. I like the idea of patience. But being an American, Americans don't have much patience. They like to have instant results. And so, noticing that in America, when Americans get behind a car, an automobile, the nicest, most cultured American male will get behind the wheel and start swearing at the drivers. And I was impressed when I first came to live in England that English people didn't tend to be so impatient. So this is, you know, we're brought up, I want something now, and I want everything, and I want it now. And so this is, the ultimate impatience. But in the training at Wat Pa Phong, demanded patience. I wouldn't survive if I didn't develop patience, because it was so frustrating, you know, to be the only untie monk in a very rural setting in Thailand where nobody spoke my language, nobody spoke English. And I didn't know what I was doing, all the Vinaya I had to learn, and I didn't know hardly anything about the Vinaya, and I had to learn through, finally there were some books on Vinaya that one could get in Bangkok. But I remember every morning puja at Wat Pa Phong, you sit there and the one monk would get up on the high seat, the tamat, and start reading the Vinaya. And most of the monks would be falling asleep. And I wasn't one of them. I didn't fall asleep, but I didn't understand a word. So this is the tradition, and Vinaya takes patience to learn to live within the confines of a created form, a traditional form. So it's a practice in patient endurance, but not just gritting your teeth, but in observing impatience. So Lumpa Cha's way of teaching was to be the witness to impatience. So I could do that. I could, through the first year of training at Wat Pa Phong, I could really witness how impatient I naturally am. As I was conditioned to be from my cultural conditioning, from my background, my culture. So then I began to feel grateful to the tradition, because I learned to witness things that I would never notice otherwise. I'd never notice impatience if I stayed in my own cultural setting with my family, because my family was impatient. And it takes something like the Vinaya, the tradition, Thai forest tradition, in which you have to slow down, you have to wait, take your turn, submit to forms that sometimes you don't understand. Bow your head, bow in a certain way, sit in a certain way, do everything in a certain way, that somebody else decides what's right and what's wrong. So Vinaya is about skillful, unskillful, right and wrong actions and speech. So clinging to Vinaya leads to a lot of guilt and fear. Because as a person, your personality is conditioned otherwise. You're not born into this tradition. You come from impatient backgrounds where your identity is always is with your faults. The inner sense of, am I wrong or right? Am I doing this properly? Am I true or false? Am I real or unreal? Always trying to find yourself in terms of right and wrong, real or unreal, and define yourself accordingly. So people can be very self-critical because of their impatience, because of their resentments, because of their fears, jealousies. Become depressed because life is, samsara is depressing experience, basically. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And so this is a reflection that we do in this tradition every morning, evening puja. Because it's true when you reflect on it. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And my first actual reaction to this reflection was, that's really sad. Because in America, we're not brought up to think like that. We never reflect on all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. So we don't know what to do when our parents get old, get sick, and die. We don't know what to do when tragedy happens. In the world now, where there's so many wars, so many people, children being killed, you know, why? How could this happen? Why are these innocent babies on the newscast, they tell about how many Palestinian babies are murdered every day in Gaza, and you think, that's horrible. These innocent children. But in terms of all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. It can happen 100 years from now to the next moment, because these forms are fragile and impermanent and changing, relentlessly changing. And they're not what anyone really is. When you wake up and realize for yourself, Dhamma is your true nature, eternal bliss, the refuge in Dhammang Saranam Gacchami. So I offer this as a reflection.